Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Balancing CV and GI Risk, Expert Perspectives, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Roxana Moran, MD, and James M. Scheiman, MD. Dr. Moran is a professor of medicine, director, interventional research and clinical trials, Mount Sinai Medical Center, New York, New York. Dr. Moran has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Ortho McNeil Janssen Pharmaceuticals, and Regato Biosciences. Dr. Moran's spouse has received research grants from the Medicines Company. Dr. Moran does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Moran does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Scheiman is a professor of medicine and gastroenterology, University of Michigan Medical School, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Dr. Scheiman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Pfizer, and Posen. Dr. Scheiman does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Scheiman does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to educate clinicians on the risks for gastrointestinal bleeding with antiplatelet therapy and the cardiovascular risks of withdrawing antiplatelet therapy. This activity is supported by Posen. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Roxana Moran, interventional cardiologist, professor of medicine and director of interventional research and clinical trials at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Our program today is called Cardiovascular and Gastrointestinal Risk, Expert Perspectives. Please note that this program may include discussion of investigational devices or agents not approved by the FDA for use in the United States and the off-label use of approved agents. I am joined by a gastroenterologist, Dr. James Scheiman, Professor of Internal Medicine, Division of Gastroenterology at the University of Michigan School of Medicine in Ann Arbor. Welcome.
Thank you.
Our discussion today will focus on the bleeding risks of patients with cardiovascular disease, particularly gastrointestinal bleeding and its consequences. As we all know, as interventionalists, we're faced with the balance of ischemic versus bleeding burdens and the risks of the patient as we are treating them. And each day when we're in the cath lab, we have to make decisions about, you know, anticoagulation therapy, prolonged dual antiplatelet therapies. And of course, we're very concerned about the bleeding risks, especially now that we understand what the consequences of important bleeding events are. Specifically, we're very concerned about non-axis site-related bleeds. There's been a lot of interesting data showing that non-axis site bleeding is even more important and more predictive of late outcomes. In fact, axis site bleeding is somewhat controlled, and we're able to kind of, in fact, hematomas alone have been shown not to be associated with mortality. But it's the gastrointestinal and GU bleeding that could be very much associated in especially intracranial bleed, as you can imagine. So curbsiding with our gastroenterologists has become a sort of a everyday question. There's been so much talk about proton pump inhibitors, whether or not we should be having our patients on dual antiplatelet therapies and proton pump inhibitors, and of course there's a lot to be said about that. And so having you here is a great, great honor, and for us to be able to kind of talk about that. So first let's start with the proton pump inhibitors and their association or lack thereof with the relationship with what's going on with thienopyridines. What do you, as a gastroenterologist, suggest or recommend for patients with cardiovascular disease who are undergoing PCI?
Well, really, the first step in approaching such a patient is to really think through what might be the GI risk factor profile for that patient. And that was really the focus and intent of our consensus document that I was fortunate enough to work with members of the AHA and the ACC, such as yourself, to really help everybody understand this idea of balancing risk. And when you're in the throes of a complex PCI, you might not think, well, maybe I need to ask about some of these other things that aren't necessarily cardiac related. And perhaps the most important thing is, does this patient have a history of GI bleeding? And even more granular than that, we have to know where they bled from, because we know that ulcer disease is something we can reduce the risk of by appropriate therapy, as you mentioned, a proton pump inhibitor. So understanding if they've had a previous ulcer, even if it hasn't bled, but even more importantly, that if it has bled, that puts your patient at really high risk when you put them back on aspirin, or you add aspirin to other antiplatelets or anticoagulants as need be. Age is an important risk factor as well, and the risk really begins to rise in a very steep manner above the age of 70. Based on other medical comorbidities, one might choose to lower that number. You need to make sure they're not using other nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for arthritis or for aches and pains or for whatever reason. And even we've learned that even low doses of steroids, greater than 10 milligrams, in addition to even a baby aspirin, increases the risk. And some nice evidence we guessed on the consensus document that might be important. And we've recently gotten some data from the THIN database published in Circulation that showed us that indeed low-dose steroids increased your risk. So if we focus on these risk factors, we can then make a decision, is a PPI appropriate? Is my patient high risk? Then I think it's an important issue about the CV side and the concern you have about your stent to try and balance this issue. Is there a potential drug interaction and what might it represent? And I think that there's little doubt that the addition of a thienopyridine will improve stent outcomes. The real question is, how much is that increment and what is the real measurable risk in terms of clinical outcomes if we combine that drug with a proton pump inhibitor? So we've learned from a lot of data that there's clearly a pharmacodynamic interaction at the test tube level or at the platelet level. There's really very little evidence that this translates to clinically relevant differences in cardiovascular outcomes. There's been a lot of observational studies. They are certainly confounded by indication, sicker patients getting PPIs, so that it's difficult to interpret those. Cogent, a randomized controlled trial that specifically asked, could a PPI reduce the risk of dual antiplatelet therapy, showed a very clearly defined GI risk reduction in terms of not only symptomatic ulcers but ulcer bleeding, and it didn't show any effect on cardiovascular outcomes. And when we updated the consensus document last year, we pointed out that the weight of the evidence seemed to support this sort of idea that there may be a test tube interaction that seems, if at all, to be relevant in terms of clinical outcomes, it must be very small, because Cogent really can't exclude a tiny interaction. So what I've learned from working with colleagues such as yourself is it's all about how concerned you are about that stent. Is it at a critical point? Is it a difficult stent that you're particularly worried about stent thrombosis? And then I would use a PPI if I'm particularly worried about GI bleeding. And people then ask, well, is one PPI any different than another? I think that's an equally challenging area because there's the weight of the evidence has been looking at omeprazole, and of course, esomeprazole is omeprazole. And again, there's been labeling around these medications. But the reality is do we really know that this translates to clinical outcomes? We're not sure. And what I tell my colleagues and my patients is there access to a particular PPI that's easier in terms of cost and reimbursement issues? and versus giving them perhaps a different one that we don't really know is really going to affect any of these outcomes. So I focus on what the patient can actually get access to. There's no reason to give more than once daily dosing, and I think that as long as your patient's getting it, I think that we know that the studies would argue that they're getting at least a 50% reduction in risk, GI risk, perhaps as much as 80%. And while it's not perfect, I think for very high GI risk patients, there's really an opportunity to reduce that GI bleeding that your own work has shown. Once GI bleeding occurs in the PCI setting, very bad things happen to those patients.
Yes, and as you know, we looked at that in the acute coronary syndrome patients and found a very, very important relationship to mortality with a GI bleed. So my question back to you is two things. One, what about H2 blockers? Is that, you know, they're cheaper, they're over the counter. A lot of my patients ask, you know, why do I have to have this expensive proton pump inhibitor? Can I have an H2 blocker instead?
Well, this question about H2 blockers was really brought to the fore a year or two ago when a trial from Scotland was published in The Lancet to try and further address this question. There are some methodologic limitations of that trial, including a very high rate of endoscopic ulcers. It wasn't a bleeding trial, and it was confounded by the use of H. pylori, and H. pylori is an independent risk factor for ulcer disease, as I'm sure you know. So the tricky part is the H2 blocker any better from this whole thionopyridine interaction question? Maybe. We actually don't have any explicit data to answer that question. We know it's inferior from the GI standpoint. And there have been direct comparative studies, albeit small, comparing the H2 blocker famotidine to the proton pump inhibitor pantoprazole in a population of patients in Hong Kong. And it clearly showed that the outcomes from the GI perspective, which were a composite of a variety of things, including ulcers and bleeding, were inferior for the H2 blocker. And we sort of predicted that when we evaluated the data in the consensus document, because we know that H2 blockers, first of all, have to be given more frequently, which leads to issues of adherence, and are associated with tachyphylaxis. There's loss of acid suppression effect over time because of upregulation of the H2 receptor. It's not mechanistically linked to as reliable degree of acid suppression as a PPI, which blocks the final step of acid production. I've seen a lot of people switch to these medications, and I would say that if you're going to do that, it should really be done in a low GI risk patient. And I think this is really challenging. I think that seeing these patients, they're complex. You have to risk stratify on the GI side and the CV side, and perhaps, you know, other organ systems as well. So it's challenging to really come up with an easy and straightforward way to balance these risks, and that's why there's been so much confusion.
Yeah, and that brings me back again to another question, because there are scoring systems that of course you're aware of. I less so aware of them, but. And we, in cardiology, we use a lot of scoring systems to look at the ischemic risk, the bleeding risk, and now I understand there's a GI bleeding or the scoring. Can you tell us a little bit about that scoring system and whether or not we as cardiologists should go and learn about them and how we should proceed?
Well, you're blessed in cardiology because you have large prospective clinical trials, so you can actually come up with a score over time because you have a large number of patients and you have outcomes. In GI, we haven't had such big trials to be able to do that. So your question approaches two patient populations, well, those at risk and then those who develop bleeding. And I'm going to touch the former first, which is I wish we had a CHAD score for GI bleeding so that you could say this patient is X age with X, Y, and Z. Their risk at 1 year is 1%, 3%, et cetera. We have some estimates along those lines, which is where those risk factors that I mentioned earlier come from. But the other issue that comes up in this balancing idea is that GI bleeding we can frequently fix with some form of endoscopic treatment. We can try and prevent it even before it develops. But cardiovascular adverse outcomes, it's hard to get myocardium back. And that's why we tend to really, and this has been a paradigm shift through a lot of education in my specialty, to focus back on the non-GI issues first and think about risk stratifying, what the implications might be of withholding various antiplatelet or anticoagulant therapies. In terms of if a patient who is in the ACS or PCI setting or has an implanted stent but is actually just having a GI problem independent of an acute cardiac event, the most important thing we have to think about is why they're on the particular agent. In terms of these, we have bleeding scores that predict mortality, and they are very useful. I think they're useful for people like me to decide whether the patient can go to a regular floor or a monitored bed, whether I need to do my endoscopy in the next hour or the next 6 hours. But I'm not sure it's going to be something that cardiologists need to worry about. It's a reflection of comorbidity, ultimately, and patients with the highest comorbidity have the worst outcome. Just like the patients in your PCI study, when they GI bleed, they tend to be sicker patients. And what we don't know, but I think would be the case, is that if we could prevent those folks from bleeding, we might be able to get them past their difficult time and their intervention and perhaps improve mortality. That's really the fundamental research question.
Well, that's absolutely right. And, you know, we have scenarios, and I'm going to put up a scenario for you and see how you would sure. help me manage a patient. So a 75-year-old woman with a freshly placed stent in a proximal left anterior descending, which is a very important artery, with a bifurcation morphology where there's a large territory of myocardium at jeopardy. The stent is placed. Everything goes extremely well. The patient goes home on aspirin and clopidogrel, and she did have a history of a GI gastroenteritis. Inflammatory. Not an ulcer, but gastritis. And so she goes home on a proton pump inhibitor because of that history. And she presents a week later to the emergency room with hematemesis. What do we do? It's a week after a freshly placed drug-eluting stent. This is not a rare issue. We get called on this a lot. And in fact, I think our audience who will be listening to this say, oh, what do we do?
Right.
And it's a bleeding. It's a freshly bleeding, freshly placed stent.
Well, I think there's two important points in the case that you presented. One is that PPIs help, but they're not perfect. And the highest risk patients sometimes do develop bleeding irrespective of our best attempts to reduce risk. There's little doubt that the patient needed dual antiplatelet therapy for this stent, a lot of myocardium at jeopardy, and a stent that's at particularly high risk because of its morphology. And I'm glad you mentioned this because sometimes people don't differentiate this. And, you know, a stent sitting way out in the periphery that was planted a year ago is very different from one that was planted a week ago in a very important location. So it's very, very clear we need to aggressively resuscitate this patient, put her in the best place in the hospital we can to do that, which would almost certainly be the CCU or another ICU. And then I think the question is, should we withhold any form of antiplatelet therapy? And I think the answer is, depending on the rate and degree of bleeding, one might consider withholding one but not both of the drugs for a short period of time. We typically would withhold the thionopyridine. It's the longer-acting drug, and frankly, even if we hold it today, it's still having its effect at the time of our endoscopy. We would absolutely continue aspirin. And the next step we would do would be move to trying to clear the stomach with lavage and then with a prokinetic agent to try and get good visualization. And we would use endoscopic techniques that would consider the fact that any short-term intervention that would cause mucosal damage, that would include various types of injection, particularly of irritating agents, or cautery, will create an ulcer. And if the patient didn't have much of an ulcer before, they're going to have a larger ulcer after we intervene. We're fortunate that we have other tools now. We have endoscopically placed clips that we can use, and those have really become the mainstay of patients that have had compromises in their ability to clot for whatever reason in our approach. So what I might do is give just an injection of something with either very little epinephrine or none to try and just tamponade the vessel and then try and get an adequate visualization and try and put a bunch of clips on to try and reduce the bleeding. I think the mistake had been made in the past that such patients, by well-intentioned colleagues of mine, stop all the medications and stop it for a prolonged period of time because of risks of rebleeding. And there's been a trial published on such a strategy, and it was quite clear that we reduced the risk of rebleeding, but there were fewer patients alive at the end of the trial because of adverse cardiovascular and cerebrovascular events that occurred because of thrombosis. So it's very clear we really have to achieve this balance. And the acutely bleeding patient is a very important one to really consider those risks in a direct discussion between the two specialties.
So would you be more prone to stop the more potent, if the patient received a more potent P2Y12 inhibitor like ticagrelor or prasugrel versus clopidogrel, or would you be more cautious, or does it not make a difference?
I mean, I think that the guidelines that I help work together with the ACC and Rich Becker wrote a specific guideline to mm-hmm. talk about this area, but also our own societies, the AHGE, yeah. the American Society of GI Endoscopy, all of them talk about stopping the phenylpyridine but continuing aspirin. I think if your patients are particularly high risk, if they're not bleeding that much, and I think I can see, I might consider even leaving them on both drugs, because the reality is it's there anyway. Only in the one case where the drug is reversible would stopping it actually have much of an effect, and I'm probably not going to wait around for that
That's
effect
right.
to wear off. The problem is much greater when the patients used to be getting these lytic agents or the 2B3A inhibitors, and we worry about those, but we have to stop those. Those really, hemostasis is very difficult in those patients with any, and we have to hold off on those. Same thing is true in the anticoagulated patient, mm-hmm. Particularly the over-anticoagulated patient. Clipping and stuff, we just can't get adequate visualization to even do an intervention, and we try and do as short-term stoppage of that and try and achieve hemostasis, much like a surgeon achieves hemostasis in the operating room, by things that won't bleed a week later.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, and lastly, once you're done, we can restart and be, and how quickly can we restart our therapies?
Well, you know, this has been a learning process for many of our folks in our specialty, and it really comes down to the confidence you have in controlling the finding. And I think that I didn't touch on this earlier, but when we see bleeding lesions, they vary in the spectrum from, for example, the lesion that we could look at in a patient where they might have just a well clean-based ulcer with a visible vessel, which has a risk of rebleeding that's much less than a lesion that's pumping blood,
mm-hmm.
for example.
Sure.
And it comes down to the confidence of the endoscopist that they've achieved hemostasis. Really, though, the discontinuation or restarting should not be based so much on the GI side, but more on the CV side. So if we're legitimately concerned, again, the bifurcation lesion, the recently implanted stent, is very, very different than a stent placed a year ago or 2 years ago where, you know, there's some uncertainty of the incremental value of long-term therapy. I think there tends to be this tunnel vision, well, we can't ever stop any drug ever once it's started. And I think in the low-risk patient from the CV side, I think we can hold off if we're concerned. And it's really important to individualize it, because just like where the stent's sitting, it's how likely we thought we really achieved. And there are little ulcers that bleed and we can clip them, and there are large, large defects that, you know, people have for differing reasons. In individualizing each patient is really important. The key thing that the study I mentioned earlier from Hong Kong that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine taught us that if we stopped aspirin, for example, we stopped all drugs, including aspirin, after that period of time when aspirin's effect would be gone, roughly about a week, in that period where they were off aspirin from, you know, a month, the patients start getting into trouble between 7 and 30 days, not surprisingly, right? So it's very clear that stopping an aspirin for more than a week is a bad idea. So I think that if we are ever placed in a situation where we are stopping both drugs, and I think that should be rare, then we clearly shouldn't stop both drugs for very long. I think, and a week would be the absolute limit. But the guidelines really do favor stopping just one, and leaving the aspirin on board, assuming that that's the combination that 90 to 95% of patients would be on following an ACS or PCI.
Well, I want to thank you for this amazing chat. I learned a tremendous amount. I know that our audience also have learned a lot, and I feel very much comforted now that the cardiologists get to decide what they should do with the dual antiplatelet agents. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity, Balancing CV and GI Risk, Expert Perspectives. To participate in the CME Activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.